Today's Thursday, February 20, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. While Russia had hoped to get the international attention upon the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, a story of far larger consequence is taking place not in Russia, it does involve Russia, but it's taking place in its near neighbor, and that is the nation of Ukraine to the west. In Ukraine, what is now threatened is nothing less than a civil war. Russia may indeed have hoped for the international attention to be directed to its Winter Olympic Games, but it is the root cause, at least in large part, of what's going on in the tragic headlines in Ukraine. As Olga Rodenko reports for USA Today, the standoff between Ukrainians who want a European-style democracy and a government that is aligned with Russia erupted Tuesday in an explosion of violence that could reignite an East-West confrontation long thought buried. End quote. Now, what we're talking about here is something that is not yet a civil war, but it certainly does threaten to become one. According to international news reports on Tuesday, at least 20 people were killed in Kiev, Ukraine's capital. Those deaths can be directly traced to the responsibility of Ukraine's president, Viktor Yanukovych. Mr. Yanukovych had been expected to sign a trade agreement with the European Union. In other words, an indication of a tilt to the West. Most Ukrainians want to be part of Europe, not part of Greater Russia. But at the last minute, Yanukovych didn't sign the agreement that would have tilted to the West, but rather one that tilted decidedly to the East, right to Russia, with guarantees of loans underwritten by the government of Vladimir Putin. So the bottom line is that the USA Today analysis is exactly right. What we have here is not just a vestige of the Cold War, but a new representation of the Cold War right before our eyes. It was just a few years ago that people in the West were celebrating the so-called Orange Revolution in Ukraine. And yet that seems now to be very far in the past. Viktor Yanukovych was indeed democratically elected by the people of Ukraine. But then again, so was Vladimir Putin by the people of Russia. And yet both of these men have turned out to be Eastern-style autocrats. Neither of them intends to give up any power. And both of them have basically led to the rewriting of constitutions for their respective countries that will keep them in power. As you look to the nation of Ukraine, we need to recognize that even more is at stake in the danger of a civil war. You not only have two different political forces within the country, one leaning to the west and one leaning to the east, you also have two very different, contradictory and irreconcilable political philosophies associated with these two groups. You also have in Ukraine, and this should not come as a surprise, a sectional or geographic divide as well. Those in the West tend to lean decidedly toward Europe and toward European identity. Those in the East are far more likely to look to Russia. But even as the headlines have been primarily about the situation in Ukraine, as the Wall Street Journal reported yesterday, violence has also been breaking out in the streets of Thailand. As James Hookway and Warnakawa Chunchuan report, at least four people were killed in clashes between Thai security forces and anti-government protesters, amplifying fears, they write, that one of Southeast Asia's most important economies could plunge into a destabilizing cycle of violence, end quote. By the way, the violence took place primarily in the Thai capital of Bangkok. Just like in Ukraine, the violence was primarily situated within the capital of Kiev, although it's also breaking out in other regional cities and administrative centers. From a Christian worldview perspective, perhaps the most important thing we can understand from this is, first of all, a sense of gratitude about our own system of government. Time and again, we point to the flaws of the American constitutional order, to the fact that right now we are facing some very severe political, economic, and even constitutional questions. We have courts acting on same-sex marriage. We have a president who's acting extra-constitutionally when it comes to offering executive orders and revising statutes passed by Congress. And we have Congress itself fossilized in terms of its political structure into gerrymandered partisan districts. These represent just a few of the political, economic, and social issues faced by the United States. But we need to recognize just how stable our government and our society has been over the last 200-plus years. America did endure civil war over the issue of slavery, states' rights, and the endurance of the Union. But since 1865, there has been a notable, even spectacular, stability to the American experiment. Much of this can be traced to the glory of the American Constitution, to the wisdom of those who founded and framed our constitutional order, men who, by and large, were explicitly understanding themselves to be establishing a system of government that was made to match what human beings were described to be in the Bible. In other words, a society and a constitution to govern that society that were explicitly grounded within the Christian worldview. This is not to say that all the founders and framers were believing regenerate Christians. It is to say that they operated explicitly out of the Christian worldview. When you're looking at the nations of Thailand and Ukraine, you're looking at an extreme breakdown of political order and of social order and cohesion as well. Another insight from a Christian perspective is the absolute necessity of a basic level of stability and security in order to have an operational society, much less an operational government. Last, we go back to that front page article in yesterday's edition of USA Today. This is, it seems, a resurgence of the Cold War, a reappearance of Cold War dynamics. In other words, the Christian worldview also helps us to understand that these basic human struggles don't just go away, even when they are declared to have come to an end. The end of history didn't happen in 1989 with the fall of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall. That took place all within about a 2 or 3 year period after 1989. Many then declared that history had come to an end, the West had won, and the Cold War and its associated conflicts were over. But of course, that was too simplistic. And Genesis 3 reminds us that in a fallen world, those simplistic solutions often are revealed to have been, well, very embarrassing utopian dreams. That must be the way that people right now in Ukraine think about those claims. One final insight from the Christian worldview when it comes to the situation in both Thailand and Ukraine. It turns out that to be made in the image of God as a human being is to have within yourself implanted a basic desire for liberty. That's what's taking so many people into the streets of Bangkok and Kiev, even at risk of their lives. Throughout human history, we've seen it before. Without doubt, we will also see it again. Back here in America, one of the most important stories of 2013 was the decision by the National Council of the Boy Scouts of America to rescind its historic policy preventing the participation of openly gay boys in the Scouts. Now, the Associated Press last week reports that the Boy Scouts of America are indicating that the organization lost 6% of its membership in this past year. Now, the leaders of the National Council of the Boy Scouts of America are telling us that you can't necessarily trace that 6% loss directly to the decision on the issue of homosexuality. On the other hand, they're acknowledging that it certainly did play a part. As the article by the Associated Press reports, the Boy Scouts have been on a slide in terms of membership for several years. Much of this assuredly has nothing to do with the issue of homosexuality. The slide over the last several years in membership in the Boy Scouts has to do with less discretionary time for kids today. Add to that fact the reality that so many boys of scouting age are now more involved in teen sports than in scouting activities. But there can be no doubt, and this story in the Associated Press makes that clear, that the decision having to do with the inclusion of openly gay scouts has had an impact, a rather dramatic impact. According to the Associated Press report, which was published in the Washington Post and other leading newspapers, at least one organization, a rival to the Boy Scouts, known as Trail Life USA, it was set up after the change by conservatives and Christian groups. That organization now claims at least 425 units nationwide, a remarkable explosion in growth for an organization that's not yet even a year old. When the decision was being debated, and actually made last year, many of us warned that this would lead to an evacuation of boys from the scouting organization. A 6% drop in just 1 year, the first year, is certainly an indication of a tremendous loss. But what's not in this article is even more important. The story in the Associated Press did not reveal the statistic of how many boys have entered the Scouts since the decision was made, or just even over the last year. In other words, the most important statistic here would not be the total number of Scouts, but rather how many boys entered the scouting organization this year as compared to previous years. Many analysts believe that that figure, if it were to be released, would indicate a catastrophic fall-off in interest in the Boy Scouts. In order to determine that, I guess we'll have to wait until that statistic is released. Oh, and by the way, if it isn't released, that will tell us something as well. A very important and troubling article appeared in yesterday's edition of USA Today, a column by Kirsten Powers, in which she accuses many conservative Christians of working towards a new form of Jim Crow. She writes, "What's the matter with Kansas? A bill protecting the religious freedom of businesses and individuals to refuse services to same-sex couples passed the State House of Representatives last week. It was blessedly killed," she writes, "in the State Senate on Tuesday." She writes that even as similar bills have cropped up here and there, including in the state of Tennessee, She writes that Christians who complain about having to, quote, celebrate, end quote, same-sex nuptials are, quote, at odds with their Christian faith, end quote. She then writes, quote, it's probably news to most married people that their florist and caterer were celebrating their wedding union. Most people think they just hired a vendor to provide a service. It's not clear why some Christian vendors are so confused about their role here. She continues, quote, whether Christians have the legal right to discriminate should be a moot point because Christianity doesn't prohibit serving a gay couple getting married. Jesus, she writes, calls his followers to be servants to all, end quote. Well, that's a very interesting misuse of scripture, but does Kirsten Powers have a legitimate point? After all, she harkens back to one of the saddest and darkest days of America's moral history, and that is the existence of Jim Crow laws, a separate list of laws for those who were white and for those who were black. Inevitably, that meant that African-American citizens were forced into a second-class citizenship. Is that what evangelical Christians are trying to do with same-sex couples and homosexuals in America? This is where Kirsten Powers misses the point entirely. She cites a couple of pastors. One of them is Adam Hamilton, pastor of the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection. She identifies that as the largest church in Kansas. He said, quote, Jesus routinely healed, fed, and ministered to people whose personal lifestyle he likely disagreed with, end quote. She also cited Andy Stanley, the pastor at North Point Ministries in Atlanta, identified as the second largest church in the United States. She wrote, quote, he told me he finds it offensive that Christians would leverage faith to support the Kansas law. Andy Stanley said, quote, serving people we don't see eye to eye with is the essence of Christianity. Jesus died for a world in which he didn't see eye to eye. If a bakery doesn't want to sell its products to a gay couple, it's their business, literally, but leave Jesus out of it, end quote. Well, let's think about what is actually revealed in the four Gospels of the New Testament for just a moment. Yes, Jesus does call for his disciples to be servants, and, furthermore, to be good neighbors. Jesus did take himself into the presence of known sinners. He allowed table fellowship with sinners. Furthermore, he defined his own ministry by saying that he had come to seek and to save that which was lost. But not one of the four Gospels in any text suggests that Jesus celebrated sin in any way. That's where Kirsten Powers and her duo of pastors listed here miss the point entirely. This isn't about simply selling a product or offering any kind of service. This is about an expressive, professional service in which the one who is conducting this business actually is having to join in the celebration of the wedding. And that, too, is an essential point. This isn't about a willingness or an unwillingness to serve same-sex couples. It's about an unwillingness on the basis of Christian and religious conviction, depending upon the individual, to celebrate a same-sex union in the sense of a wedding ceremony. My colleague Denny Burke made that point emphatically clear when he recently addressed the issue at his website. As a matter of fact, Denny Burke went so far as to accuse Kirsten Powers of bearing false witness. He wrote, none of the Christian business owners cited in recent reports are refusing to do business with gay couples. They are happy to serve gay people, and they have served gay people. In fact, I think one of the business owners even had a gay employee. Doing business with gay people is not the issue. They simply do not want to be forced into participating in a gay wedding. That's the issue. But that is totally lost in Powers' article, and it totally undermines the analogy to Jim Crow, end quote. Turning now to the city of Philadelphia and a very different issue, the headline there has to do with a couple who believed in faith healing who were sentenced yesterday to 3.5 to 7 years in prison in the death not of their first child but of their second child to die after never seeing a doctor despite being stricken with bacterial pneumonia. As Channel 6 ABC News affiliate in Philadelphia reported yesterday, Herbert and Catherine Schabel defied a court order to get medical care for their children after their 2-year-old son Kent died in 2009. Instead, they tried to comfort and pray over 8-month-old Brandon last year as he, too, died of treatable bacterial pneumonia. Catherine Schabel said to the judge, quote, my religious beliefs are that you should pray and not have to use medicine, but because it is against the law, then whatever sentence you give me, I will accept, end quote. The Schabels are identified in the media as third-generation members of a Pentecostal community known as the First Century Gospel Church, which is located in northeast Philadelphia. Now, this church has very extreme teachings. Not only does the church say that those members cannot go to medical doctors, including for their children, even when they're sick with a treatable disease, they also are not to use seatbelts, they're not to go to college, and they're not even to wear eyeglasses. According to a federal report, every year about 12 young people between the ages of birth and 19 die every year because their parents denied them medical treatment, claiming instead faith healing. What are we to think of this? Well, in the first place, the Bible does say that God heals. In fact, the Bible makes clear that all healing comes from God. But the Bible also makes very clear that God uses means in order to accomplish His will. And one of those means is medicine. There is nothing in the Bible that suggests that there is anything wrong with the practice of medicine, and to the contrary, there is evidence that there is much that is right. No one in the Bible is criticized for calling for a physician. Luke, the author of the third gospel, is himself identified as a beloved physician. Faithful Christians, thinking from a consistently Christian worldview, understand that modern science can be arrogant and pretentious. It can involve all kinds of biomedical complications and threats to human dignity. But as a discipline, a profession, and a science, modern medicine is also essential to human happiness, human health, and human flourishing. Christians are therefore to receive medicine as a divine gift given to us as a very helpful means by which God accomplishes His purpose and determination to heal. As we are told in Isaiah chapter 53, the one who came as a suffering servant came to heal us of all our diseases. But in His first coming, He came to deal with the issue of sin, as the writer of the book of Hebrews makes very, very clear. When He comes again, there will be no more sickness and there will be no more death. But until then, we should receive the gift of modern medicine as just that, a divine gift, a means whereby God accomplishes His purpose of healing. As a final aspect of that very sad situation in Philadelphia, we raise the issue of religious liberty and parental rights. Were the Schabels within their religious liberty rights to deny their children medical care even when it led to their deaths, even when we note intervention was at hand and accessible, and even when they had every reason to understand that the denial of medical care would lead to the death of their child? The answer to that question has to be no. And it's easily seen as no when you put it into the context of, for instance, the law denying anyone the argument that they committed homicide in the name of their religious beliefs. One does not have the right to bring a harm to another, especially a harm as serious as death, simply because one claims either parental rights or, in the case of this couple, both parental rights and religious liberty. We must, as Christians, defend both. Defend the priority of parental rights and the absolute essential character of religious liberty. But there are some actions, or in this case, inactions, that simply cannot be covered in terms of responsibility by either parental rights or religious liberty. Even beyond that, we have to recognize something we repeat over and over again. Theology matters. In this case, theology meant the difference between life and death. The theology preached by this church is unorthodox, it is unbiblical, and it flies in the face of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Theology matters. In this case, the sad and tragic evidence of that truth is seen in the death of two very little boys whose all too short lives remind us that theology matters. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Nashville, Tennessee, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.